Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Welcome, everybody, to this special edition of the Motorsport Magazine podcast. It's part of our 100th anniversary series that marks a very significant year in the history of the original racing magazine. To celebrate motorsport hitting the magic ton and its founding as the Brooklands Gazette in the summer of 1924, we will be bringing you a very special podcast every month throughout 2024. We've invited some gilt-edged motorsport heroes and longtime friends of the magazine to relive the key moments of their racing lives. I'm Rob Widdows, your host for all the centenary podcasts. And today, my special guest is Dario Franchitti. Dario, welcome to the Motorsport Centenary podcast. It's really, really good to have you with us because what a remarkable career you've had, really taking off when you went to America, and the rest, as we know, is history. And we'll talk about some of that in the next 1 hour. But first of all, before we get into that, do you remember when you first became aware of Motorsport magazine? Was it in the family? Was it in the house? Did you go out and buy it? What happened then?
I do. I remember it very clearly. And I was in my grandparents' house in Italy. And there was a copy of, it would have been late 70s, I wouldn't have been more than 5 or 6 years old. And there was a copy of, it was at the time when it had the green cover with the white lines. And I remember just sitting and going through it and looking for the pictures. And that was my first memory of it. And I think it would have been around 78, I think. And it was those F1 cars with the big, those 79s, Rapid BT46, the Fang, all that kind of stuff. And I was a reader. I wasn't a reader at that age. I looked at the pictures, but I've been a reader ever since.
Yeah, it's great. My dad used to read it to me when I was a boy. One of the nice things about you is that you're very aware of the history of the sport at which you've done so well. And also, of course, you not only have Scottish blood, but you have Italian blood. So, motor racing just runs right through you, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. And, I certainly blame my dad for that. It was his hobby, his fascination that really got me into it. I remember sitting watching races, watching Grand Prix with him. One of my first memories of doing that. And then I would go, he raced as a hobby, worked really hard during the week to pay for it. Raced Formula Ford and ended up, I think the biggest car he had was a 792 March that he raced at Ingolstone, Knock Hill, sometimes Croft. And, I used to go to the track with him. And that just further cemented it. The sounds, the smell. I can still hear a BDA, and it takes me back to being five, six, 7 years old. One of my favorite cars is a Chevron B19 because I saw them at Ingolstone when I was a little boy.
It's great, isn't it? Because you just get hooked, don't you?
Completely, and it's. I was going to say it's bad. I think maybe the expression is good. It's as good today as it ever was. I'm as addicted to racing cars, to road cars, as I ever have been. I'm as in love with the sport. I'm as in love with cars. I'm kind of looking off to the left of it, a glass wall to my garage. I love it as much as I ever did, and I feel really lucky, really fortunate that it's that way. And it's because, I mean, how many people get to, you know, I think I was 5 years old when I decided I wanted to be a racing driver. And here we are 45 years later, and it seemed to work out okay.
Yeah, you could say that. we'll talk about what's the other side of that glass wall a bit later on, I hope. But a few years ago, Motorsport ran a feature with you about a very special Lotus Cortina that you'd bought. I wanted to start by asking you about Jimmy Clark, because, I mean, he died before you were born, and yet something about him has captured your imagination, hasn't it?
Yeah, it has. I guess it's quite well known in racing circles, my Jim Clark sort of fascination. But I would point out, if you can see here, there's one helmet behind that's not mine. It was that man's introduction to Jim Clark, I think, to the legend of Jim Clark that piqued my interest. I would have been 18 years old, actually 19. And Jackie phoned me and said, "Hey, I want you to come to..." I'm not going to do my Jackie impression today. "I want you to come to Scotland. We're having a dinner to commemorate 25 years since Jim's passing. Would you come along? I think you'll enjoy it." And that was it. And that started this fascination, like I say, that whether it's buying race suits, helmets, cars, reading about Jim. I mean, there's a whole shelf of just Jim Clark books. And, you know, he absolutely fascinates me still because of that. I guess it was his personality. You know, everybody you talk to, whether it's Jackie, Graham Gold, you know, Dan Gurney, all these people who knew him very, very well. That sort of almost split personality of this absolute gentleman. But then he got in the car and just there was this will to win. And that fascinated me from the first day as it continues to now.
I wondered, actually, because throughout your career, winning all those races, all those championships, there was very, very little controversy or overt aggression around you. And I wondered whether what you'd heard about Jimmy, what you read about him, affected the way that you handled yourself at the top level of racing.
I think some of that comes from who the people that influence you. And yet Jim definitely from afar influenced my thinking, but it was my dad, it was David Leslie, father and son, it was Jackie. So I think it was that, but I definitely, as I got older, I became harder edged. I think there's no doubt. When I was younger, I was maybe, I wish I had the not aggression, but the desire. I wish it was, I mean, it was by the end, it was pretty strong, yeah. But I wish I had that when I had the speed of youth.
Yeah.
I was able to balance it. And one of my old great friend of mine, Kyle Moyer, who now works for Penske, and he was my crew chief and then my strategist at Team Green. And Barry Green just wrote a really good book about his life in racing. And Kyle said something in it about me. He said, "I never raced other people. I always raced myself."
Uh-huh.
And I thought that was fascinating because it's maybe why I had such great relationships with my teammates.
Yeah.
It was because it wasn't that inter-rivalry. I just wanted to do my best, and whatever else happened was almost secondary. Almost.
Is it necessary to be a bit ruthless to win the amount of things you've won, races, championships?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You've got to be very selfish. There's no doubt. You've got to be ruthless. You've got to be selfish. But there's a line, isn't there? And that line has moved, as long as I've been a racing fan, that line has continued to move in what I would call the wrong direction. But maybe that's me being a 50-year-old old person now. But you have to, yeah, you have to take everything to the limit of what, you know, whatever that is. And that includes what you think is acceptable. You know, with teammates, I was always of the impression that we're better working together, because then we can fight out for first and second, whereas we fight each other, we might be fighting on track for fifth and sixth or worse. So, and then there was a certain amount of, you know, if you're better than me on any given day, then good luck to you. And that with some of the teammates I had, that happened quite a lot, because I had bloody strong teammates
in
my career. But that was, yeah, there was a certain etiquette, and trust me, sometimes I got involved and stuff on track. I was like, oh, that was a bit much. And a lot of times I was just fighting my corner, just doing my best to not be pushed around.
I suppose we could say, couldn't we, that Will Power was arguably the only man with whom you had a bit of trouble. I mean, at times it got pretty tense, didn't it? How did you handle that at the time? And looking back, do you think you handled it well?
Yeah. You know, there was an incident, I think, in Toronto. It was Toronto when we touched. And the way I look, even now with the benefit of over 10 years of hindsight, I look at that and I think people drive around that corner side by side all the time. If you hadn't tried to cut across, you wouldn't have ended up in the tires. And him and I, we pushed the limits. We pushed each other's buttons. And there was just, it was always a rock meets a hard place. We always both thought we were right. And it was a great rivalry. And we actually get on very well now. And I've got massive respect for him. He's bloody quick. But he's probably the only driver I ever played psychological games with. And I think the only reason I say that is because most of the time I didn't care with other people. It didn't interest me. Again, going back to that racing myself, like, do what you want. I'm just doing my job. I don't care what you think you can win or whatever. None of that interested me. So I just got on with my job. And with Will, I got involved in a bit of sort of active sparring, shall we say, and it was quite fun. It was fun because I came out on top of it, but he definitely learned some lessons there, you know, and he won the championship and he's won a 500 since, so he's definitely learned the lessons.
There's a point at which, isn't there, where it can become dangerous, that kind of stuff. It doesn't really happen in other sports, but when you're doing 200 miles an hour, inches apart, a rivalry can get out of hand, can't it?
Yeah, absolutely right. And you know, Rob, we've seen that throughout the history of the sport, haven't we? We've seen it. I mean, right, just popped into my head there was Villeneuve Peroni. But, you know, particularly today, you look at the safety of the cars and you think, okay, yeah, it's not as, it's so much safer. But it's still a dangerous sport. And especially with the oval tracks that IndyCar races on, you cannot, without being too crude, you can't take the piss. You've still got to have that respect. And when you don't, that's when things happen. And I think that's maybe why the driver, certainly in my time, had more of a, as much as there was a rivalry there, there was a respect between them, and you all in one degree looked after each other a bit. Some people confused that with lack of competitive spirit. Maybe it wasn't that. It was just you understood that, you know, you were doing a very dangerous thing.
Talking about the tracks in America, they are also part of the appeal for the fans like me. Those great tracks. I mean, I'm thinking Road America is one great example. They are thrilling tracks in the sense that they are a little bit dangerous. They are a bit old-fashioned. And therefore, they are also a challenge, aren't they?
They really are. They really are. I mean, Road America is still my it's my favorite. I mean, I did Spa for the first time. Never been to Spa before. I was like, okay. But it's that challenge. It's that defined limit of track. It's that tightrope that if you go off, there's a gravel trap. There are runoff areas, there are gravel traps now. They're not just crazy dangerous places, but I think at Road America there's one corner with track limits, potentially two. First corner in Canada now. But otherwise it's old school. There's the grass, there's the gravel, there's the curb. Don't go over it. You're gonna crash.
Yeah.
And then there's the layout of a track like Road America. No chicanes. It's as it was when it was built.
Yeah.
You know, the average speeds are right up there. Lots of fast corners, lots of technical corners, undulations. And I loved that. I loved it from the very first moment I drove it. And, you know, I loved the challenge of a street course too. And then with IndyCar, you know, 1 week you're at Indianapolis. The next weekend you're in Milwaukee on a one-mile oval. Then you're in Detroit on a bumpy street course. Then you're at Mid-Ohio. And it, you've got to try and master all these disciplines, which I love that. I love that challenge.
Yeah. Can I put you on the spot and ask you if you could, who's the best you ever raced against?
I'm sitting here, I've got a rather large oil painting of Greg Moore just to my side. I think on an oval it was Greg. Shortly followed by Dan Weldon.
Really?
On the oval side of things.
Yeah.
Both incredible. Overall, three names spring to mind. Zanardi.
Yes.
Because he never knew when he was beaten. Psychologically, the strongest person I've ever met. The hardest person to beat. Montoya. Raw speed.
Yeah.
He just loved racing against Montoya. And then Scott Dixon, just quietly going about his job, racking up six championships. And like, you know, I was his teammate, and I remember going into the Ganassi team. I'd had that year off in NASCAR, and I just thought I really wanted to do it, but I thought, oh, just I don't want to embarrass myself. And it didn't actually end up pretty well with it.
Yeah.
The three championships back to back, but I really thought that Scott was going to basically kick my arse. And he was every day. I had to show up, and I knew I had to show up. I sat opposite him in the truck like we're sitting right now. And every day I knew that I had to bring my A game. I had to be on top of everything, because otherwise I was going to look ordinary and you know, be embarrassed. So he was very special. And funny enough, I've just listed three drivers that all drove for Chip.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Top drivers, top team. It's interesting, actually, because I spoke to Jimmy Vassar a few weeks ago, and Jimmy Vassar chose Zanardi and Montoya as the toughest people he came up against. He said the first time Montoya went out to do some testing on an oval, he was so quick. Jimmy said he just packed up, went to the airport and went home.
But this is where Jimmy would, knowing Jimmy, I've known Jimmy a long time, he's a great friend, he would be unfair to himself. Those boys learned so much from Jimmy. Jimmy was the first champion that Chip had, but Jimmy was so open to his teammates and taught Zanardi and taught Montoya a massive amount. And you know, the Ganassi target, Zanardi, Montoya success.
Yeah.
Jimmy was a huge part of that after winning that first championship for Chip in 96.
Interesting. We all know that you enjoyed a very long and very fruitful IndyCar career, but it finished horribly abruptly with that crash in Houston in 2013. How much longer would you have gone on racing had you been able to? Were any thoughts of retirement in your mind at all?
Yes, they were. Not thoughts of retirement from racing, but thoughts of retirement from IndyCar. Because we'd had that incredibly successful 9, 10, 11, 12 period with 500 wins, well, 2 500 wins and 3 championships in that timescale. But I could feel my motivation just trailing off. And that's very important to me. And that's, I had to, a lot of my commitment, my speed came from having that motivation. And I didn't want to be, I used the same expression back then for myself, I didn't want to be the weak link in the chain. I knew how hard everybody worked. And I just thought, oh, this is, it's getting ready to be time. So what I did was I went, I was talking to Porsche about the 919 program, and I'd gone to Weissach. I'd met Wolfgang Hatz and those guys. And, you know, at the end of that conversation was a handshake, and right, let's get do something for, I think it was 15. Because then I knew I could put almost a full stop on it.
Yeah.
Give me a finish line to aim for. And obviously the accident happened and that didn't happen. I didn't get to do that. But I'm sure I could have stayed around a bit longer. But I was getting to that point. I was just turned 40. And there's extraordinary people out there, like Dixon's one of them. He seems ageless. I don't think I was that person. So now, 10 years later, you know, I wasn't allowed to race for a while. Now, as you know, I get to race old cars. Yeah. I think that shows my passion for racing. But now I drive as quickly as I want to, not as quickly as at times I had to. And so, yeah, it was getting to be close to time. Yeah, I wish I hadn't gone through all the pain.
Well, yes.
You know, that was a, and I think about that every morning, trust me, when I get up. But it was getting to the end.
That pack racing on the ovals back then, I mean, it was very, very dangerous. Yeah. Well, I'm telling you, I'm assuming, you know, all you guys must have realized it was getting exceedingly dangerous.
It was, and it was horrible. And the good news was with the DW12, that kind of racing finished. The bad news was the car was called the DW12 because Dan died in the last pack race, the ultimate pack race in Vegas. Just, yeah, it was a horrible form of racing, and none of us enjoyed it. I became, I thought, quite good at it. But that was the one, when you went short oval racing or you went to Indy, you didn't have to, you weren't, that was not pack racing. That was lovely, old, traditional oval racing. Whereas you went on these 1.5 mile tracks and it was just madness. So again, that's where you formed some of these bonds because you had to build this trust with people. And when you look back on it, just think, what were we thinking? What was this series thinking?
Yeah. Yeah. How hard was it for you to adapt to life as a retired racing driver? Especially as it was forced upon you. It wasn't your decision.
I don't know if it was that bad. It might have actually been the better situation because I was so happy to be alive that, you know, it didn't register for a while, to be honest. And I was very lucky in that one of my first conversations, I had to call Chip and tell Chip I was not going to be driving anymore. And I don't really remember this very well because my brain was sort of all swollen up and everything. But I believe during that conversation, he's like, well, we want to keep you around. You know, you've got this sort of information in your brain, whatever way of doing it, way of going racing that we want to tap into. And here I am 10 years later, still doing it. So I think I was very lucky from that point of view. And I found so many things to do, and I did the FETV stuff. I'm now working with with Gordon Murray on and the team there on all the T50 and 33 and all these cool projects. So I was never a loose end. The one thing I miss is being completely focused on one thing. Just one absolute focus in your life on one thing. I miss that at times, but without it, I'm a much nicer human being. And, you know, probably nicer to hang out with for my wife and my kids.
There's always a silver lining.
Exactly.
However ghastly the events may have been. Mm. You mentioned Gordon Murray, and of course I wanted to ask you about that because, first of all, what a great offer. Come and help me develop this absolutely, unbelievably wonderful car. But that's very different, isn't it, from racing? So presumably you were able to bring all those years of driving very fast. Was that really what Gordon wanted you to bring to that car, or was it much more than that?
No, I don't think it was really anything about that. He wanted me to bring my attention to detail and the sort of the lessons that I'd learned on how to develop a car through years of racing. And I don't do a lot of the day-to-day development. Our test drivers do that, and then they sort of hand it off to me. And I've got quite a clear feeling in my head of what I want it to feel like. So I'll be like, yeah, that's good. Let's keep going down that road. Or, ooh, that doesn't feel right. And then we might have a bit of an argument about it. And then when we're all happy, when I'm happy with that stage, it goes to Gordon. But it's about a road car. It's not about, this is not about making a super stiff racing car. Road car. And I've owned a lot of different road cars in my life. I love them. And it's about, I bring that experience of those road cars that I've owned and the ones that I've loved, the ones that I haven't liked quite so much, what makes them successful, what makes them interesting, what makes them fun to drive, what gives you that driving perfection, you know, at 50 miles an hour, 150 miles an hour, you love this car. And so that's been that part of it, and it's been so much fun. And now we've got T33, T50S, which is a track focused car, and then the T33 program and on and on. So work with Gordon, it's just brilliant. It's every day is a school day, and yeah, it's just so much. He's a hero to me, and so I sometimes have to sit there and pinch myself. But then the team that he's created as well, this team that he's built around him to turn his vision into reality, it's such a special group of people. And you know, he's now got me going to Guildford 3 days a week. Be careful. If Gordon wants you to do something, don't let him feed you full of red wine, because you'll agree to anything.
Well, we all know the man's a genius, don't we? It's as simple as that, really, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely right. I get on with him ever so well. I feel ever so fortunate to have that relationship with him.
Yeah.
Really, that's been a wonderful thing to do, and I've learned a whole new part of about cars. It's nothing like racing. Racing is a completely different beast to building road cars and all the hoops and the hurdles that manufacturers have to jump through now to pass homologations and all these things.
Are you going for the GMA T50 or the T33?
I am having a T50. I'm having one of the prototype cars. I've got a space for it just over there. I'm excited for that. I've obviously driven it a lot. And it's just, what a thing. It drives, it gives you the feelings of driving an old car. It gives you that interaction, those emotions of driving an old car. But you know, with modern technology, it's a thing of wonder.
That's very interesting, actually, because there are some good modern, well, there are a few good modern cars around, but they don't have any feeling. They don't. They're so good that you don't really feel you're having to drive it.
No.
And so to bring that into, for Gordon and you to bring that into hyper modern car is wonderful.
Yeah, as I say, there's a team of people there that have tweaked and rubbed on this car, and actually quite a short span of time to make it what it is. And Gordon's led the charge. Oh, absolutely, as I say. But it's been fascinating to be part of it.
Can we talk a little bit about your road cars while we're on that subject?
Mm.
Because I've seen a few of them on Instagram, and apart from being incredibly jealous, I wondered why you've chosen the ones you have. So if you could tell us a bit about your collection, that'd be great.
Yeah, absolutely. So the Instagram thing's interesting because I love looking at other people's pictures of cars on Instagram and when they share that. But there's a very fine line between sharing your passion and coming off as a bit of a... And I do struggle with that because I love sharing that hobby, that passion that I have. So sitting here, I wish I could turn this screen around. We've got my F40 closest to the window. Had that for 25 years. And just the most wonderful car, just raw, just a firework. Just the most incredible car. And every one of these, I've taken something good or bad. I've taken it, and when I've been sort of focusing on T50 and what I wanted to feel like, and it just so happens, luckily, that that's also what Gordon wants to feel like. Next to that, we've got the Porsche Carrera GT. Bought that after winning the 2010 Indy. I was rewarded myself. I won a big race or a championship by a car. That's in Guards Red. Quite an analog car.
Yeah.
Had a bit of reputation to start with, but Michelin made new tires for it and completely transforms its lovely car. Really, really, really a great thing. Next to that is a completely different thing, an Aston Martin V8 Vantage from 1984. I just love it. It's just a big brute. Then we have the Singer 911. The colour in that car is actually called Dixon Bronze because I named it after, it's a bit of a joke between Scott and I. That's just a wonderful thing. It's just such a special car. The Lancia Integrale.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, just an old... It's so funny. It's like, why is this squeaky old box that sounds bad? Why is it so much fun to drive? I love it. And I drove that today down to Dunsfold. Next to that's the Ferrari Daytona Spider. It's one of 18, what they call European cars. And that thing is... a bit of a rocket ship. Joe McCarry looks after that for me. We've done a little bit of rubbing on it. Wonderful. And then next to that is a friend of mine's Lamborghini Miura.
Ah.
In lime green. It's not mine, but he sent it over to, yeah, basically asked me to do a snagging list on it. Take that for a couple of weeks, do a snagging list, would you? So I've done that, and I've also done his 250 short wheelbase recently. So that's a good trade, isn't it?
I don't know what to say. I'm lost for words. I don't know.
I feel incredibly fortunate. This is not like, yeah, I get to do this. I feel so fortunate that these cars are mine, but also that I get to drive and be entrusted with cars that I've just mentioned. And then there's the pace cars and some other stuff up in Scotland.
Okay, here's a tough question.
Mm.
I think it's tough. You can only take one to your desert island. Which one is it?
I mean, now, and this is not corporate. No, now it's T50.
Okay.
Because it it does everything.
Right.
Yeah, I think it's 50. But as I look at them all right now, they're all so different. And here I'm like, I couldn't, you know, 50 would have to be because it does it all. Whereas I can pick reasons why and why I shouldn't pick all the other ones.
Well, it's a bit like asking who's your favorite child, isn't it? It's a completely, exactly right. it's a totally unreasonable question.
Yes.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Let's go back to IndyCar for a while. Would you call yourself a driver coach for Chip Ganassi? It's certainly
not within Chip's hearing, I wouldn't.
Okay.
Somebody called me that once and he said something like, I pay you too much effing money to be a driver.
So tell me, how does the relationship work? Because there you are, you're at the races with your wonderful old team. And of course, I mean, you have a lot to give. I mean, you know, for obvious reasons. How does your involvement work with Chip?
So at the races, I have a war room with different screens and data and video and in-car video and all this. I've got all that stuff, access to that stuff, and I can talk to any of the timing stands. I talk to the engineers, and if the driver is plugged into the intercom system of the stand, I can talk to the stand. One of the cool things is I can do it from right here. But that's the one thing I missed then, is being able to look the drivers in the eye after the session and have a discussion. But that's a very real-time thing. But the way it works when I'm not at this, and it also works this way at the circuit, but one of the engineers, Brad Goldberg, who was Marcus Ericsson's engineer, Brad's just texted me half an hour ago, say, hey, let's have a catch up tonight. Let's talk about X, Y, and Z. And then would be one of the new drivers coming to London for lunch. Having a bit of a chat about what we're going to do, what we need to achieve next year, all those things. Maybe it might be an arm around the shoulder, it might be some motivation. It might be a day at Rob Wilson. So there's all those things, helping put the right people in the right jobs. And we've got the most phenomenal management team headed up by Mike Hull, who's got so much experience in racing. Yeah. But occasionally he'll pick up the phone and say, what do you think of that? And that's so, as well as the driver part, there's a whole other side to it. Which I find fascinating. I love it. I love my involvement there. With Scott, it's interesting because we're great friends, have been for a long time. And finding ways to help him. With him, it's marginal gains. With a rookie, it might be quite big gains. And it seems to be quite popular. You know, McLaren have hired Tony Kanaan to do a similar thing. Jimmy Johnson. Jimmy was with us in Ganassi. Jimmy's, they've hired Matt Enseth to do a thing. Chip said the other day, he said, hey, I think you started a trend here. And I said, no, Chip, you started a trend. You're the one that's hired me.
Okay. Well, we've got to talk briefly about Scott Dixon for so many reasons. What I'm interested in is, what is it? Can you identify what is it about the guy that makes him this little bit special? Because he is, isn't he?
No, he is. He really is. And every time you think, and we'll put it another way, every time other people think, starting to back he comes. And at the end of this season, what do you mean, three races? He is, you know, you would say in some ways you think, oh, he's one-dimensional. He's not. In no ways is his personality one-dimensional. He's such a interesting, lovely person away from the track, but you put him at the track and he just reverts to type and he just becomes this machine. And he's only interested in winning. All that sort of stuff I'm just talking about, it goes away and it's like, right, how are we doing this? And every moment when he's at the circuit and when he's in that sort of racing zone, he's just a machine. He's got this desire. We talk about it a lot. Scott and I talk about it. The other drivers I talk with about it. If you haven't got the heart, if the fire's not burning, it doesn't matter how good you are. His will to win, his passion is still there. And I think when it stops, I think he will retire and be like, yeah, done, thanks.
Yeah.
But that longevity has been incredible.
What's fascinating is to watch him come from the back, which he so often does, especially last year. And the strategy, the way that the team handles the strategy in conjunction with him is very, very impressive, isn't it? I mean, people are standing at the finish thinking, how the hell did he do that?
Oh, last year there was one race. I'm trying to think which one it was. And I was literally belly laughing because people were just griping. How did that happen? It was like they'd just been robbed and they didn't realize how, their pocket had been picked and they had no idea.
I think it was the Indy Road Circuit because do you remember he was off the track on lap one?
Right, lap one. I think it was there or was it possibly. Oh, I can't even remember. Anyway, it was brilliant. I just laughed because. So on his timing stand, he's got his engineer, Ross. Ken Brooks is his assistant engineer. Mike Hull does a strategy, but then Chip's on that timing stand too. And Chris Simmons, my old engineer, who is the sort of the performance director of the team, he's there. And they all work together somehow, that many personalities, that many people come up with a strategy. And what Scott's big gift, I think I helped him in this a wee bit, is fuel saving and being quick while making fuel. And it's a real gift that he's now got, and he's really honed it to a degree. It's quite ridiculous. I always laugh about it and joke about it, saying it's because he's a tight Kiwi. As a tight Scotsman, I just imagine I was paying for the fuel myself, and all of a sudden he can make the fuel mileage. But that puts that gives him so many options strategically, and they get the job done. It's phenomenal. And you put him in, you've got Alex Pillow and one of the other cars in the 10 car. It's a strong 1-2 punch. And then you've got Marcus Armstrong, you've got Kiffin Simpson and Linus Lundqvist as rookies. Five cars. It's going to be busy, but it's a hell of a driver string.
Let's talk about Dario Franchitti's best races, shall we? When you look back at, there are so many, but... is there one or maybe two that you look back on with the most satisfaction, a big smile in your face, that really was a good performance?
I would say Surfers Paradise 99.
Yeah.
For several reasons. So to paint the picture, Montoya and I are right there in the championship going at it. Screwed up a couple of weeks before in Laguna and Vancouver. I'd really made a bit of a mess of it. And I had to qualify pole and win to stay in contention. I qualified on pole by nearly a second and led a load of the race. And I remember Montoya was behind me and I just kept pushing harder and harder and eventually crashed. And so that was that was what I was attempting to achieve by pushing so hard, but I won the race. And that performance, that was another level for me. And it was also the last race before Greg was killed. And that was, so racing was still fun. And I have that car at home up in Scotland. And so that was the last, I would say for that reason, it was a performance. 2012 Indy 500.
Yeah.
You know, at one point we were last. I was last. We had been spun in the pit lane, and I came through. And obviously, that's the whole Sato thing on the last lap. But that coming from the back to the front in about 30 laps or whatever it was.
Really?
I looked at that. But you know, you say my best performance. That was a team performance, because obviously the strategy, the setup on the car, Chris Simmons and I told him what was wrong, and he found the answers. And that thing was a rocket ship through traffic, as was Scott. And so but those two really, I would say, spring to mind.
Can you put me inside the car on a qualifying run at the Speedway? It's completely electrifying to watch. And I've often wondered, I mean, you must know this, is what is the secret to those incredibly quick laps?
I think we did an article, didn't we, do one for Motorsport? Wasn't there one? Because I read it recently. I don't know why I read it, but I was like, that was quite good. And it goes through the whole mental process of it. Your car has got to be quick. There's all kinds of work that goes into making a car fast at Indy. And it starts the week after the race finishes with a whole different bunch of people, a whole development team that just work on Indy stuff throughout the year. But you've got to imagine that when you go qualifying at Indy, you've got the boost gets turned up on the Friday and the Saturday and the Sunday. It was 3 days, fast Friday and then pole weekend. So you're arriving at the corners 10 plus miles an hour quicker. So the corners are actually, they feel tighter. That's the upshot of that. So you've got to trim the car out further than you want to do it. You've got to get the car, the balance, absolutely on the limit. And because the wind direction changes the feeling of the four corners, it might be one corner, you're actually sort of almost backing the car into the corner. Mm. You can't turn the wheel until the car settles into the banking. And then another corner, you might be fighting with understeer. And it's the tightest of tight ropes. So you'll be adjusting your weight jacker to move the weight across the car to change the balance. You'll be adjusting the anti-roll bars front and rear. Corner to corner, you're just willing the car to just not slide as you're just trying to thread this needle. You're coming into the wind's up your bum. You're coming into turn one or three at, I don't know, 245 miles an hour. I've got a picture on my phone of one of Scott's qualifying laps last year, and he's about mid corner, and the speed's 232 miles an hour, mid corner. Wow. And I used to love it. I loved qualifying. And now I watch them do it. I've got my head in my hands. It's such a test of precision from team and driver. Mm. And bravery. You've got to add bravery in there, because there's no runoff areas. And it hurts if you get it wrong.
Fascinating. It's so fascinating because, as you well know, people always say, you know, well, what's the big deal? And you just turn left four times. Really annoys me, that, I must say. For you, America really was the land of opportunity. I mean, my goodness me. What did you like so much about the American racing scene, having raced in Europe for the first part of your career? Was there something about it, something about the place, the atmosphere, the vibes that appealed to you as well?
I like racing in Europe. I was very happy throughout my sort of formative years. I loved being in the DTM with Mercedes. And I didn't know what America was going to be. I just knew that, you know, the F1 thing was looking difficult.
Yeah.
Typically, I moved to America and then a door opened, but that's a different thing. But I like the non-BS aspect of American racing. It's cutthroat in a way that everybody wants to beat each other. But I think it's more honestly cutthroat. You know, and when I go to European tracks now, for contemporary racing, I feel, you know, sometimes it's just a bit, oh, this is, the knives are out. Which you have a level of competition, you have maybe even higher. I mean, as you said, the racing is so competitive in IndyCar, finding an advantage is unbelievably difficult, but it's done in quite an honest way. I enjoyed it. I felt at home. I've loved this next phase of my life, though. I've loved going to, you know, to with historic racing, Goodwood, Silverstone, Spa. So that's been a whole new part of life. And it's been fun to experience these tracks and these cars and the people involved. Ever so much fun.
I guess, you know, you are in a small group of people who really should have been in Formula One. I mean, I'm thinking of maybe Tom Christensen, a couple of others, maybe even Scott Dixon. Do you have regrets about any of that or not? Or was America such a success for you that it's irrelevant now?
So I've been asked that question a lot, and I took the opportunities I was given. When I went to America, there was really, Mercedes were my sort of benefactors, and Norbert and those guys weren't really interested in having me near F1. They were happy with me in DTM, and they, you know, through Paul Morgan at Ilmor, managed to get to America. But then as soon as I got there, Ron came calling about becoming a test driver for McLaren. And, you know, I didn't do the deal because I didn't like the sound of it. And then the Jaguar debacle happened, and for all kinds of reasons. So I always said no, you know, I wouldn't give up one of my 500 wins or any of that stuff for any of it. No. But I was at Silverstone recently for the young driver, for the Aston Martin Autosport young driver. And I was with Johnny Herbert. And Johnny and I were both limping up the stairs. And there was this big picture of Johnny with his British GP trophy. And I thought the one thing I would have loved was to have raced at my home Grand Prix.
Yeah.
That would have been special. So apart from that, I think I had a pretty good go of it.
Yeah, I reckon. Yeah. What do you think about the sudden an extraordinary popularity of Formula One in the United States right now? I mean, there were days that I remember well when you could barely pay people to go and watch a Formula One race in America.
Absolutely right.
Is this a flash in the pan? What is happening, Dario? Because the Americans love their NASCAR, they love IndyCar, but Formula One seems to have swept them off their feet.
I think that, yeah, it really has. That the, I'm not even saying race fans, but the casual observer has really taken to it. Drive to Survive has been so successful. And they've done a great job at putting on a party atmosphere, promoting a an event. You know, the new owners have done such a good job. And whether that's in the US, even if you look at what Silverstone have done, I mean, Silverstone now is such a brilliant on-track extravaganza, but off-track, you know, Stuart Pringle and that whole team have just done such an amazing job in keeping up and in a lot of ways leading the world in how to put on an event. So there's a certain degree of the on-track stuff is a bit hit or miss as far as, you know, whether it's a good race or not. But I think it's got to be good for the whole sport. I think it's got to be good for everybody. I'd like to see the Andretti team get their F1 chance. That would be, I think that would add to the sport. I understand the financial reasons why the other teams don't want them there. Maybe they can square the circle on that, make it right. But I mean, let's not beat about the bush. This is purely financial from those other teams. There's no other reason. And I get their point of view. I get their point. But I think there's a way, there's a negotiation to make everybody happy. I think it would be wonderful for the sport. I think it would be wonderful for the sport in America too.
I totally agree. Mario says he's going to be the first guy to drive the car.
I don't doubt it. I mean, we've got, with T50S, our track car that's coming out, that's sort of GT1 Le Mans car quick, Gordon said, yeah, I'm the first one to drive it. All right, boss. Off you go. And I love that enthusiasm. You know, Mario's just... Yeah. I'm sitting here, I've got one of his helmets up on the shelf. Mario is... He's just Mario, isn't he? He's just so special.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, to use a horrible word that's used way too many times, he is genuinely a legend of motor racing. I mean, you know, what hasn't he won, for God's sake?
But with him, as you said, he's got this legendary status, but if you could take his enthusiasm for driving a racing car and bottle it, you know, I know kids at the start of their career don't have that passion that Mario's got. He's special.
Yeah. Okay, look, finally, do you think that what Roger Penske has done for IndyCar the last couple of years is similar in any way to what's happening in Formula One? And I ask this because right now IndyCar is incredibly exciting racing. There's a lot of cars, a lot of drivers, a lot of very good teams, and it's very watchable, thanks in part to how available the drivers are to the public, to the fans, and how apparently open-minded everybody is. Has Roger given it a bit of a kick up the bum?
I think the sport was doing that part on its own. I think what Roger has done is in his organization is provided the stability, which was much needed, you know, especially around about the pandemic. Who knows what would have happened without the, you know, the Penske organization. And ultimately, let's be honest, without Roger, what would have happened to the sport? I think, for me, you know, we always push for more, and I really want to see the Penske organization, Penske Entertainment. I want to see them think outside the box a lot more and really adapt to the changing times, which I think F1 have done ever so well. So I think that would be my one challenge. Otherwise, Roger's, it's very interesting to watch him being the owner, custodian of the Speedway, and how proud he is of that. And that's cool. I think in that moment, he goes back to being a kid watching the 500 with his dad at the Speedway. And he's like, I think he said somewhere in an interview, he said, I hope my dad's proud of what I've done. I'm like, wow, I've never heard Roger talk like that. But he, yeah, that would be the one negative. Otherwise, the thing he brings is he's Roger Penske. He can get in the room on an equal footing with anybody in, I'm going to say the automotive business, but also in the world. And that cannot be underestimated.
Yeah, I mean, I guess Roger Penske right now, part of his mind is on trying to beat that guy, Chip Ganassi, because Ganassi's on a roll, isn't he?
Yeah, we've had a good time. We've had a really good success. We've got a strong group of people and we're pushing hard. Every person is pushing hard because that old saying, you stand still, you go backwards. But you've got the Penske organization, as you know, you've got the Andretti organization, you've got McLaren.
Yeah.
Zach is just hungry for success there. And then you've got all these others. I hate to call them smaller teams, but and they can get it right on any given day and challenge. So we've got to keep pushing. But it's been lovely to be a part of it. It's long may it continue.
Absolutely. Motorsport magazine coming to 100 years old is in itself an achievement, bearing in mind that the media is constantly changing, especially recently with social media, satellite television, you name it. Would you hazard a guess as to why the magazine has lasted as long as it has and still has a big following? Up against, as I say, you know, a lot of competition, really. And I know that some of you guys do read it occasionally. How do I know that? Because I talk to you.
Exactly. I've got every edition since 1960, I think.
Wow.
All bound. I think comes down to the writers, because you know, whether it's going back to Jenks and everybody who's come since, they know their subject, they're passionate about their subject, and it strikes a chord with us, the reader. You know, when I look back and I read the Jenks's travel column, and there's the BRDC made a book of it. It's up there somewhere. My God, you just want to jump in your car. That's why it's that it's you open it and you think, oh, I didn't think about that. Oh, but I want to know more. That is not an easy thing to achieve, but it comes down to the people who do the job, who are passionate about it. As a racing fan, we're lucky. We're lucky to have the magazine. Cannot believe 100 years. Fantastic.
All right, for just a last one before we go. A lot of people listening may well be wondering if you're going to keep historic racing, keep coming to Goodwood, keep coming to the other historic racing events.
Yeah, my plan is to keep historic racing. I love Goodwood. We won in the GT40 at Goodwood. Sean Lynn and I won in his beautiful car last year. That was about as fast as I want to go around Goodwood in that thing. What a car. But yeah, as long as Goodwood, Spa, really anything in fun cars with fun people, I'm going to keep doing it. I was lucky to do it with it was one of Sean's cars at Spa, and it was Sean phoned up and said, do you want to race the GT40. I said, all right, are we racing Tessie, his car? I said, no, I'm going to do that with Max, his son, and another friend. He said, do you want the other car? You, Marino, and Jimmy can do it together. So my little brother and our great friend Jimmy Johnson and I did it together. And Marino had at least done, you know, a lot of laps of Spa, but my first lap was on Wednesday in practice. Jimmy's first lap was on Friday in qualifying in the rain at night. So we all loved every moment of it. It's so much fun. These cars are so interesting to drive.
It's also wonderful entertainment for all the people who buy the tickets and get to watch. It's just great entertainment, right? Yeah.
Oh, absolutely right. I mean, when Goodwood Revival was on, I was at Laguna for the last IndyCar race. And I was up at 4 o'clock in the morning watching practice, races. It's just brilliant. It's so exciting. And yeah. The good news is there's no clashes with anything next year for any of the Goodwood events. So I'll be there for the full dance card.
Yeah. Bring some IndyCar guys. We love it.
Yeah. Scott and I were talking about it. I've got breakfast with Scott on Monday and we're going to be talking about our plans. And Jimmy's got all kinds of plans. Jimmy's all excited about Goodwood as well. And as usual, the Duke's been so, so kind to us. So watch this space.
Jimmy Johnson, NASCAR team owner now.
I know.
Hey, look, Dario, you've been fantastic. So entertaining, as always. Thank you. Thank you so much for taking part. And great to see you.
You too, Rob. Take care.
Bye.
See ya. Take care.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.